tech replacing financial services, flexible offices replacing long leases, and a market that is shifting east. London's occupational story is being rewritten. I'm Damien Wild, editor of EG. There's no better way of telling this unfolding tale, perhaps, than to take a look at Farringdon's Ray building. LinkedIn is nearing a deal to take around 57,500 square feet at the redeveloped former HQ of The Guardian. New media is replacing old in every sense. Debates may rage around London's future as a global financial centre, but one plotline is beyond dispute. The new masters of the universe, Amazon, Facebook and Google, have been expanding their footprint in the capital, seeking to win the technology sector's fierce war for talent. And so have startups. Monzo, the challenger bank, is leading a pack of second and third generation tech startups, expanding their office take-up in central London. To discuss this intriguing tale of London's next wave of occupiers, I'm joined by a panel who have rare insight into how this narrative will play out. Sherin Aminoshe is Head of Offices for the International Court of London at Lendlease. Dan Bailey is Head of City Agency London for BNP Paribas Real Estate. Ben Gillam is Founder and CEO of the Third Way Group. And Taylor Westcote is Director of the Concrete PropTech Venture Capital Fund. So, Dan, I've given an assessment of the occupational market in London today. Does that chime with what you're seeing?
Generally, Damien, it does. But actually, we were just looking earlier this week at quarter one's take-up in central London for major occupiers. And for me, that was a microcosm of the choice that occupiers now have in central London, both in terms of locations. So there was strong take-up from the likes of SMBC, traditional city buildings and locations like 100 Liverpool Street. You then have towers with Sydney and Austin going to 70 St Mary Axe. You then have people like Monzo taking two-year leases from Bloomberg in Finsbury Square. But at the same time, you've got Charles Taylor Insurance taking a tiny bit more space, but on a 20-year lease as opposed to a two-year lease. They've done that because they wanted a big incentive up front to help pay for their fit-out. So what I think to me is interesting is, compared to when I started doing this job over 20 years ago, the choice that occupiers have in terms of lease length, style of building, locations, you know, Canary and here east, there was some good take up in this quarter. And I haven't even mentioned yet serviced offices and the offering that you can get there. So I think, yes, the threat of the new, or not the threat of the new, the new occupiers coming through into a market have driven some new behaviours from landlords. But I think the overriding thing for me is choice. There is a lot more choice there.
So it's still very mixed. We talk a lot about the new media companies, the new tech companies that are coming through, but financial services isn't falling away.
No, it's not falling away. And I think, you know, it's partly about style of building, location and lease structures. It's also, as Ben, I'm sure, will sort of talk more than I will about, it's about workplace and how that looks. And yes, there are lots of people who want something new, something different, but not everyone wants exposed services and sort of raw brick walls and steel on show everywhere, in the same way not everyone wants a very bland vanilla white ceiling. So there's choice now, which is great.
Okay, Ben. Dan talked about choice there. We're in a fairly traditional midtown building, I suppose. You work with a variety of companies. Is your base skewed very much more towards the creative sector, or is it the mixed picture that Dan talked about?
No, it's very much the mixed picture. Our clients range from, you know, creatives to fairly institutional businesses. I suppose what we are seeing, though, across all industries and all sectors is a convergence of design. That people are trying to create spaces that aren't necessarily defined by their exposed services, but defined by their employees and their clients' experiences. And that's what we're seeing more than anything else at the moment.
Okay. And is that is the picture the same in every sector, or is there still variety?
I would say there are differences in sectors, but if you took the receptions and kitchens, okay, as prime examples, 10 years ago, you'd walk into the reception and it would be just for visitors. You wouldn't see a member of staff in the reception. And then you would take the kitchen, it'd be hidden at the back of office. It would just be a galley kitchen where the staff would go and it'd be a complete mess. That's completely turned on its head now. You're just as likely to walk into a reception and see it as a living working environment, perhaps even with the kitchen and breakout area front of house, because what people are trying to do is set the tone for the business as you walk through the door. Also, what we're seeing is across sectors is there's a war for talent. I think what technology has done for all businesses in all sectors is take away a lot of the menial jobs. So a lot of the jobs that companies and industries are creating are collaborative driven. So it's people driven. People communicating is so important. So the drive for design and office design is making sure there's so many environments and areas where people can meet, collaborate and work well together.
But there's an appetite for change among the insurers who are taking 20-year leases as there is among the challenger banks taking 2-year leases.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a desire for change. I think the problem is there's perhaps not enough knowledge or there's not been enough education in those industries about what that change should be. We were talking earlier about agile working. It's a big buzzword, but it can mean so many different things. And what our job is to actually get under the skin of the business, find out what they're trying to achieve and actually give them a design solution that meets that.
Okay, thank you. And Sharon, you're at Lendlease now. Until a few months ago, you were working for the government property unit.
Yep.
Is that picture very different in the public sector to the private sector?
In some ways it is and it isn't, but for me I can look at it from a very recent big occupier perspective as well as a developer perspective. So from the occupiers, just before I left, we'd announced 9 deals on hubs basically. And for us, that choice was a really, really positive thing because the ability to go there and look, we have this amount of take up, this is the kind of thing that we want, we could very much dictate our terms. Now government is more conservative, so we weren't going for as much as the sort of exposed service or whatever. But so choice for us was really good. From a developer's perspective, what's important for us now is to actually be a lot more nimble and flexible and think about what our occupiers may want, but without, you know, putting on the same product time and time again. It was interesting. We were having a little workshop looking at workplace design with some of our architects, and they showed us what they said were going to be 80 pictures of different types of workplaces from these co-working providers. And actually, after about 30, I lost the will to live because they all looked exactly the same. So I think there is something to be said about more choice, but real choice rather than perceived choice.
Okay, you got to something quite fundamental there about a recognition on the part of landlords that they need to change, that they need to be more flexible. Do you think most are ready?
I think some are ready and some are not. I think property in general is quite a traditional sector in so many ways, in terms of technology, in terms of the way we build our buildings, but also in the way that we change. Property isn't always a fast business, and therefore that seems to permeate through the sort of cognition of the people who are involved in it. I think we need to think more about who we want our future occupiers to be and actually prepare them, have more incubators as part of our spaces, so that not only are we supporting the next wave of businesses, but we're actually also growing the pipeline of those who may want to be our customers and tenants in the future.
Okay, thank you. Taylor, that must be music to your ears. That the point about flexibility, perhaps not the point about property not being a fast business. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So I think flexibility is probably a key theme that we'll see, and not just in office occupation, but we see it in residential. We see it in industrial and logistics. We see it in retail. And so I guess in the office space, while someone like JLL, one of our partners, has predicted that 30% of office will be flexible in the coming years, I think that's only covering the SME customer segment. When we think about the larger businesses, simply, we're starting to see a trend there where, for example, WeWork is becoming the outsourced office provider for very large organizations. And so this idea of businesses continually pulling in their focus to their core business and just really outsourcing all the stuff that they don't necessarily want to invest the time and money to learn to be very good at can drive total cost of occupation down even. And when that sort of realm of flexibility increases, as companies are refocusing around the changes that technology brings to their workforce, we see that, well, we think that owners are becoming increasingly asked to think as operators, which is an uncomfortable position for a large property owner to have to kind of think regularly and often about how their customers are experiencing the space. And there are increasing ways for them to get an understanding of that with, say, like apps for the end employee within a building. So the visibility into that information is just kind of increasing the cycle and increasing the speed at which someone can keep tabs on how well their space is working, how well it's operating, how efficiently it's operating from an energy standpoint or what have you. And that's driving a higher velocity to every aspect of the market.
Okay, I was going to build up to WeWork, but you brought them into the room there.
Hard to avoid WeWork real estate conversation.
Of course, I feel I should issue a BBC-type disclaimer and say other service office providers are available. Yeah. But it's WeWork that's really changed the market, hasn't it? And forced everyone and the different groups that are represented in this room today, perhaps forced them to change as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, WeWork certainly one of the biggest stories in real estate in the world today. From a valuation standpoint, probably the shock of the amount of money they've been able to raise compared to, let's say, their total space. It's just sort of a different multiple than the real estate world has seen in forever.
Well, a tech company multiple rather than the real estate.
Yeah,
company.
Exactly. And then in addition to that, the recognition, there's so much take up from the audience, there's a recognition that there's a real opportunity here. So in London, for example, I think there are probably 1,200 co-working spaces, and there's about 400 in New York. So a real change, which I'm happy to say is being led by London. And so I think everyone's pretty excited about that. And it drives everyone to think about, well, what are the aspects of the experience there that are moving people into that space? Is it just flexibility? Is it perhaps a higher quality of service? Is it an increasing focus on the experience of the new demographic of workforce? Everyone is wrestling with their own solution there. A very large round raised by Industrious in the US not too long ago. One of our partners, Fora, very much focused on bringing hospitality ethos to the workplace. And I think all of them are seeing great success. So we're at the beginning of a long climb towards what I think will be probably a larger percentage of flexible office space than anyone thinks.
Okay, thank you. Ben, in media a few years ago, whenever a magazine went through a redesign, the editor would come in and say to his art director, make us look a bit more like wallpaper. Do you get a similar message now, make our space look more like a WeWork space?
Maybe 18 months ago. If I'm being honest, now we get, please make us look nothing like a WeWork. I actually spend a lot of my time in co-working spaces, meeting companies who are actually quite desperate to get out and get their own identity. And I think that co-working have created some really, really inspirational spaces, but they're not aspirational. And most businesses in there are startups, they're growing, they're run by entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs want their own front door. And yes, I agree with all the comments here, it's about flexibility, and a lot of the work we're doing as a business at the moment is working with institutional landlords, helping them design spaces that are typically units of around 2,000 to 8,000 square feet, and actually creating environments that they can brand as their own, as incredibly flexible spaces in terms of lease length and how they rentalize their income. So I think what we're going to see now is the fight back from the real estate market.
Actually, so the backlash is there already?
Yeah, it's happening, and I like to think we're at the front of it, and we're working with some really great landlords who are, you know, meeting the problem head on and saying, actually, we want these types of tenants, we want these occupiers, we want them to grow with us and grow within our estates. And it's quite an exciting time for an occupier, because choice is coming and flexibility is coming. A lot of our tenants that we work with, you know, when we're sitting down and taking their brief, they don't know if they're going to be 40 people or 200 people in a year's time. It all comes down to the funding and them hitting their targets. So they want that flexibility, but they want that front door and sophistication of being their own business and having their own identity.
I wouldn't call it a backlash, but I do see what you mean. And interesting, again, looking at the take-up stats for last year in central London, whilst take-up was higher than it was in 2016, if you look at take-up in units of under 5,000 square feet, it was 50% of the five-year average before. And we certainly felt that in our team. And the ongoing debate during last year for where we've got clients with units of 2,000 to 5,000 square feet. It was, right, what do we do to get this space to let? And funnily enough, some of it's about pricing, but actually the most successful has been a bit about lease flexibility, but also actually landlords turning around, not doing a lot, but putting in a kitchenette, putting in a proper fibre backbone, getting wayleaves sorted out so that people can get into that space quickly. So there is a bit of repositioning, and certainly we've seen so far in quarter one a bit of a tick back up there. So I think, again, it comes back to what we're all saying. It's about choice. And yes, you know, the provision of WeWork or the Office Group or whatever isn't a sort of a massive cure-all or a solution for every real estate situation. But it certainly, it gives that balance. And where you were mentioning, Taylor, about 30% being in flexible space, I think the good news is now there are blurred lines, aren't there? There's everything from taking space, you know, in a co-worker, to having your own discrete space in a serviced office, to going to take a managed deal maybe on a sort of 2-year sublease or fag end lease from a building owner, up to going into a more mature building, taking a longer lease. The other thing that I didn't mention earlier, a lot more of the landlords on the bigger deals in the UK are starting to do what would be more commonplace in the States, where, hey, you take 150,000 square feet, but you get an option to take another 20 or 50,000 in a few years' time. That was always, no, we don't do that in the UK market, whereas that is definitely started to become more commonplace, particularly as you get bigger estate owners, whether it's a Lendlease or Bridgeland, who've done that in a number of their deals recently in Broadgate. So again, it's just a better solution for the occupier, which, you know, they're the customer.
One might imagine that we'll see occupiers have contracts as sort of like, I'm the senior occupier, I have first dibs on space as we expand and contract, and I expect you as the operator to manage the space that I'm not using right now, right? You want to stick a temporary company in there, you want to put some flexible desks in there, fine. 3 months from now, that may need to change. And I think asking your operator to do that for you so that you can stay focused on your business, I think is a trend we'll see, as in the, you know, the WeWork handling Amazon space.
It's interesting though, if you think about co-working as a total proportion of the amount of space available globally, it's still relatively small. But for what is actually relatively small, the impact that it has had on people's thinking.
It's changed behaviours.
Exactly, and it's made some people nervous. And I think the important thing is also the hospitality angle of it. Long gone are the days when, you know, you rocked up into your office space, the receptionist didn't know who the hell you were. Actually, that's still the case in some places. And that was it. That was your space. You're now having to think about the fact, okay, I might have a portfolio of offices, so what are the extra services that I am having to give to my tenant? So is it the flexibility to be able to take spaces across the portfolio? Is it the extra space? Is it a shorter lease length? Is it a concierge type of service that, you know, traditional office provider wouldn't have given before? So it's interesting, the pull of the little, what you started as quite small about 10, 15 years ago, has had such a pervasive influence.
And you say long gone, is it 2 or 3 years gone? Is it further ago than that?
I think it's probably, it depends, I think. You look at Regus, which was the granddaddy of the co-working space, but it never really took off. But they had that ethos from the sort of fairly early days. But still, a lot of the occupiers have said to me, you know, we work in quite bland spaces. It could be anywhere. And also, we don't get that extra service from our landlords. So yeah, it's probably not as long gone as I would like to think it is.
Okay. And to Taylor's point that landlords need to act like operators, how's that change manifesting itself at Lendlease?
It's something that we're taking quite seriously, especially since our pipeline of projects is very much growing. So hopefully soon we'll be in a position where we have a larger portfolio of buildings that we can offer to our tenants, and we can start, as you said, thinking like that operator. So what are the services that we're going to be giving to our customers to actually make their workplace somewhere where they spend a lot of time during the day, but they actually want to be, and they actually want to stay with Lendlease rather than going somewhere else?
I think another aspect of demand that we'll see surfacing, and for example, that WeWork and Office Group can clearly address is, okay, we've got our main office, but you know, I've got a bunch of employees that live in West London and some in East London and some in North London, and I don't want to need to force them to commute every single day. And so when I sign this contract with you, can you make sure that we've got an office over there that they can use at need, or maybe some flexible space? And I think that meets the needs of a more, you know, on one hand dynamic, on the other hand demanding workforce that occupiers are sort of starting to build with the millennial generation.
I think technology is a big part of this as well. So first of all, the most important thing was to have your offices Wi-Fi enabled, but now it's gone broader than this. So when a potential occupier comes to this and says that, you know, we think we operate in a certain way, and they will have a certain view of their workforce, their business plan, and the way that they use space. And they come into the space, and you realise from the data that you're now being able to collect through a building, through the way the lifts work, through the way the meeting rooms are booked, and so on and so forth, that actually the way a company perceives itself is very different to the way they are actually using the space. So actually a savvy landlord can very much work with them and say, actually, no, we can optimise the way that you're using the space. Not necessarily tell you what colour your walls, your cushions should be, but actually this suits your working style better. Or do you want to amend your working style so actually you can have a more efficient use of your space, a more efficient business at the same time?
Yeah, I would certainly echo that. We meet tenants, take briefs, and we found that once a business gets to 40 or 50 people, the ownership team, the leadership team of that business have no idea how they actually use that space, how meeting rooms are used, or the efficiencies. And increasingly, we're using technology to get in early and actually collect data and say, well, this is how you're using your space. So actually, when we design your new space, this is informed intel that we can do to make sure that what we're creating will work for you now and also for the duration of your lease, whether that be 2 years on a flexible term or five, six, seven.
And it's at the tipping point, 40 to 50 people, where an organisation goes from a small to a unwieldy, perhaps?
I wouldn't say unwieldy, but I would say it's where realism needs to kick in, and owner managers have to realise that they probably don't have their finger on the pulse as much as they did when it was a 20 or 30 person organisation. So that's certainly what we found, that kind of 40, 50 number, the data you can pull just by, you know, using the Wi-Fi infrastructure that's in place, the tenant has in place, will give them a far better indication of how they're using the space than what they actually believe they are doing in that space.
Okay, I'd like to move on to geography and talk about different parts of London and emerging and perhaps retreating parts of London. But just before we do, a last point on flexibility. And Taylor, it's a way you describe your activities and your business that struck me. We invest first to help you find product market fit. When you're ready for your growth phase, our investors are ready to help with an industrial scale rollout. Given all we've talked about landlords and their ability to be flexible, and the fact that lease lengths are coming down in some instances, but not everywhere, can existing lease structures accommodate industrial scale rollout?
So
is it inhibited by?
When I refer to industrial scale rollout, I'm referring to the industrial scale rollout of the technology propositions of the companies that we're investing in. I think we're all in agreement that lease structures are changing. There's an increasing role for operators like WeWork, like the Office Group, to take the operational weight off of the landlord. And then some landlords, of course, are trying to kind of fall into line with that. Is it really going to change lease structures? Yes, I think we're seeing a continual transition towards the more flexible demand. If you think about, you know, what a landlord really prefers, which is just a really long lease, and they don't have to hire a whole bunch of people to build an operational staff, I think we'll see an intermediation of that. So WeWork, perfect example, right? We'll take that 20-year lease, and we'll deal with all the tenants, right? You're no longer giving that to tenants, you're giving it to one tenant, and then we'll deal with all the end customers, and we will reap the benefits of flexible pricing, and we will invest in the optimization of continuing to fill that space, whereas previously you would just take a low price for a really long lease, and then you could just leave it. So I guess we'll see the change in that direction.
I suppose what I'm asking really is that if landlords don't change quickly enough at a time when there's, you know, great competition among cities for to be home to these fast-growing tech businesses, yeah, whether it's Berlin, whether it's London, whether it's Paris, and if landlords in London don't change quickly enough and become more flexible quickly enough, will that drive business away?
So businesses will demand that. I think landlords can either invest in doing it themselves, which is non-trivial. I don't mean to say it's just something they need to do themselves, or they can outsource that to others, right? And we see a range of ways of doing that, right? You just give a long lease to WeWork, or you could make a deal with an operator, and there are many co-working operators out there that are happy to say, look, you know, give us a building, we'll operate it, we'll keep it full, share the risk and share the upside with us. So there are a whole range of opportunities for them to move in that direction. It doesn't necessarily mean they need to build a co-working capability and an operational team within their own organization.
Okay, thank you. And Dan, there are plenty of good examples of landlords, building owners becoming more flexible, yeah, and either working with an outsourced provider or offering it themselves. But are there meetings that you come out of shaking your head with some and think to yourself, well, they're going to be in trouble unless they get with the program?
One or two. I mean, I think the interesting thing that you know, we're all, I think, in agreement that there is a reasonable amount of choice and flexibility in London. What the landlords have stuck with, and I think UK landlords will continue to do so, is the full repairing and insuring lease, or the equivalent of that, which is different to many other countries. What we'd see from the weight of money that's coming into London is that if you've got a good multi-let asset that you're bringing for sale, if it's, let's say it's a sort of 10-year income let to a single occupier, that'll probably go for a similar price point to a multi-let building that might only have 5 or 6 years sort of weighted income, because the landlords know it's multi-let, they can churn, they can make use of that income, and they haven't got all their eggs in one basket. So I mean, I've had, you know, not naming too many names, but we did have one client who came in one day and said, I've got a great idea. We'll let this whole building to X being a large serviced office and co-working office. I said, well, I'm not sure we could probably do that, but you need an exit here. You need to be able to sell this building. And this building, 100% let to X with a special purpose vehicle on the lease without a parent company guarantee, is probably not going to give you the value that you need. The next week they came, oh no, you guys were right, we never want to let any space to X. And well, actually, that's probably not what we were saying. Actually, getting X or one of their competitors into this building as part of the mix would be a good idea. And that's what we ended up doing in the end. So there, you know, and I think the interesting challenge as a leasing agent that I'm going to have and my colleagues are going to have over the next few years is that most of my career I've been advising well-known UK or Western European or North American experienced building owners and operators, REITs, call it what you will. With 70% of the ownership now of new purchases coming from the Far East and the Middle East, many of these new landlords are coming to buy assets from really mature sort of experienced operators in London. And I think the challenge will be, let's say you've had a building that was developed by Lendlease or Derwent London or Blackstone, they're now owned by a Chinese tile manufacturing business as their sort of investment platform. Are we in danger of seeing the sort of high point of maturity and collaboration and sophistication of London landlords, because you're going to have these overseas owners who think they've just bought an income stream? I hope not, because the wise ones will employ sort of sensible UK asset managers to look after them. But I think that's if my concern actually going forward is, yes, how those new owners cherish, and I think it's an overused verb, but curate the assets that they've bought in London.
When will we know?
when all the occupiers head off to Paris and Berlin. No, trite answer. So,
do you think it's a relatively recent phenomenon, yeah, but at scale, but there are longer standing examples. And so, you know, we're a number of years into that process. Do you see evidence of that, or is it just a latent fear?
I think, to be fair, it's a latent fear. I haven't seen too much irrational behaviour. I mean, I suppose there are one or two long established sort of Far Eastern or Middle Eastern landlords who have had stock here. And, you know, honest view, they're not always the most adaptable. Some of them are, some of them are not. So I think the interesting thing for UK property professionals is the excitement should be, rather than seeing that as a negative, the excitement should be to help advise and motivate and provide the evidence really to those owners of how they need to adapt. And logic suggests they haven't made all that money by being sort of one-eyed and stupid about life. So hopefully it's an irrational fear, but it's a bit of a fear nevertheless.
I think that's probably a good point as we move on to thinking about the transaction, what the owner is ultimately looking to achieve. If you let the whole thing to X, all you're going to know is the yield that you're producing. You're not going to understand the operational costs. You're not going to understand the optimization of the yield itself. And so there's increasing technology to, let's say, benchmark your sustainability across similar assets and drive more frequent valuations in an automated valuation management fashion for commercial buildings, your ability to realize, I think, a greater price comes from a greater understanding of what's happening within your building. And that's one advantage of getting a little bit more operational.
Although there's an interesting point in terms of balance of geography and talent, which you can find. And this isn't necessarily representative of the whole industry, but I was chairing a session on next gen for New London Architecture. And the majority of people in that room, sort of mid-30s and below, were seriously considering, and some in quite advanced stages of considering, of going overseas because of Brexit. And that's quite an interesting point. So if you, and this is, again, it's quite a small group of people, but if you extrapolated that across other industries along the same age range, there was a question that you were asking about, you know, are millennials different? You know, do they have horns? Do they have tails? Or are they the same as the rest of us? But there is, the younger generation seems to think there are more opportunities elsewhere. And if that is actually borne out by evidence and that really happens, then there will eventually be a question of, do I want my corporate HQ to be here?
No one wants to come in on that point. Again, I'll ask the same question that I asked to Dan, actually. Is that a fear, or do you see evidence of that already?
I've only seen small pockets of evidence. But so, you know, you can't create a whole business plan on small pockets of evidence. But it's something that I think we all need to be really mindful of. And it goes back to what we're saying. So we give a better serviced offer. We give greater flexibility. We're mindful much more of our tenants' needs than we have been in the past. It's not just giving a floor plate to somebody and going, buy, here are the keys. I'll see you in 20 years' time, because that doesn't bear out anymore. So I think fear is good, because fear allows you to innovate and not think that things are going to always be the same.
I think we're in an unusual waiting period right now with the whole Brexit debate. I think employees will go where the money is and where the opportunities are, and that tends to be where the money is. And so it's still here at the moment, I think, very clearly, certainly in the startup sector. London funds more early stage startups than any city in the world, and has continued to do so since the Brexit vote. But I guess once that changes, we'll have to adjust to the new reality.
Okay. And it's money and talent, isn't it? Which moves first, generally, Taylor?
I would say probably money, right? So money for the talent. If you think about where is Google opening their new office, that will be a big draw. I think government incentives will play a big role in that. And so I think everyone's crossing our fingers that the UK, throughout this sort of broader Brexit debate, formulates a clear and compelling technical strategy so that we don't have, for example, software developers from Lisbon saying, no, I actually don't want to take that job in London because I don't feel welcome there. And I don't know what's going to happen, you know, a few years from now. I just, you know, read all kinds of news articles that change the tone every single day. I think I'll stay here or I'll go to Berlin. It's a lot cheaper and there's a lot more happening there. And by the way, Google, I'm not saying they did open an office there, but you know, once they do something like that, it tends to be a bit of a indicator of where things might move.
Okay, we could go down the Brexit road for the next 20 minutes, but let's try and avoid that. But do bring it back up if you feel so minded. But I wonder where the future of London is within London. Is it north, south, east, or west? Ben?
I don't think companies feel as geographically tied as they once did. We work with a lot of creative businesses that, you know, traditionally should have been Shoreditch and Clerkenwell. They're looking at the city. I actually think it's quite exciting for them, the city. I think landlords are quite excited by the thought of getting a creative occupier in and seem to be giving them quite good incentives. There's big floor plates, so there's opportunity for growth. So I don't see it as regional. I just see it as, are landlords prepared to offer a good deal? Are they prepared to offer flexibility, as Dan mentioned? And I think if they are, they'll get a great tenant. I'll give you a good example. A client of ours, I'm sure they won't mind being mentioned, it is Carwell. They used to be based across the road here at High Holborn, and we've done 4 fit-outs for them in 4 years, and they've grown from 30 people to 350 people. They've just moved to Victoria, but the landlord gave them a good deal, let them be very creative with their fit-out, take out the suspended ceiling and spray the exposed surfaces that were there, and they're very happy in that space and that location. And I think that's what we're seeing as a designer for occupiers, that they're prepared to go where the value and the flexibility is.
Okay, and Dan, News Corp's a good example, taking someone south of the river at a time when that wasn't tremendously common.
I mean, I think, interestingly, with going back to news, when I met them, and there's a story in that in itself, the speed at which they went from thinking about doing something to doing something. But they said, right, where can we find sort of 400,000 square feet in a single building in London? And I said, well, there's a variety of buildings in Canary Wharf. There's a big pointy one on the South Bank called the Shard, and there's its sort of its baby brother or baby sister. I said, well, we're not going to Canary Wharf. And so, you know, history wrote itself, and they ended up going down to what's now the news building that was the place. I think there still are people who are saying, I don't want to go to the wharf, but I think that is starting to change, and I think the government taking a big hub down there will make a difference. I think Ben's right, people are more Catholic in their tastes about where they'll go in London, but the little fact that I hear so many times that I haven't checked whether it is a fact, but now that 50% of London live to the east of Tower Bridge, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure they will sort of email in sort of on the podcast, that surely means that whether it's Canary and what that brings to offer, and fair play to Canary, they're reinventing themselves with Wood Wharf, whether it's Lendlease and the International Quarter, whether it's ABP and the Royal Docks, that's where the critical mass of major new development is happening. Yes, you've got Croydon, that's becoming a success. Looking west, you've got White City and Chiswick. Actually, the one part of London, being a North Londoner, North London doesn't really have an equivalent to a Stratford and Canary in the east, the White Cities and the Hammersmiths in the west, and the Croydons down south. Whether Argent related and what they will eventually do at Brent Cross changes that remains to be seen. So I think it's sort of east is the most obvious dominant place because of the opportunity, whatever asset class you're looking at, you know, it's staringly obvious.
Sharon, I've got a feeling you might mention Euston.
I could do, couldn't I? That's sort of north, isn't it?
To the north, certainly.
It's north central, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, for me, I've been a sort of North Londoner or Northwest Londoner almost the majority of my life in this country. And it's actually interesting when we're looking for hubs in government, and I will come on to Euston in a second. We had a real issue finding the right location with a developer who was willing to put something in North London that would work towards the demographic that we had in that part of the country. And actually, as far as I know, there still isn't a proper northern location because it was actually really difficult to find. But going back to you,
and, sir, sorry, just what were those criteria, for instance, if there is a developer, whether it's Argent related or another, that is looking to attract a big occupier, what boxes should they be ticking?
So at the time, it was very much transport. So transport isn't an issue in North London. So that was a good tick. Whether we had the right people in the place to come to it. So that for us was another tick. But then there didn't seem to be developers who actually had too much on the stocks, or at least anything of an appropriate scale, or were willing to scale it up, which I thought was quite interesting. Because if you think about the catchment area of that part, so Luton, Milton Keynes, going further north as well, on all those railway lines, I still haven't quite grasped why that hasn't become an attractive location. I think partly it's because it's seen as very residential. It's never been seen as a business location. The Valuation Office Agency did have a building in Edgware for a while, but even they moved out and didn't think it was appropriate for their needs. But it goes back to if you don't have to be location specific, you can work from anywhere, and for the majority of workforces in other places, why go to North London, the furthest of North London, if you know there isn't appropriate office infrastructure there. But going to Euston, I think there is such an enormous opportunity there, and obviously we're very, very excited to be part of the retelling of that story for that part of London, because you see what's happened in King's Cross, and Euston is very much the sort of natural next stop. You look at the Euston Road, you look at the institutions around there, especially around the knowledge economy, UCL, Wellcome Institute, the Crick, the British Library. It has actually quite a strong residential focus to it as well. But the problem is Euston Road has made sure that that's never really been a place, even though it's probably one of the best connected roads in the whole of London. So the challenge for us is to bring that into a place, to make that into a location in its own right that's not the same as King's Cross or not the same as somewhere else, but has its own DNA. And I think that will be a really exciting new chapter in terms of central London and a new location, a new workplace as well, especially with the links actually to the rest of the country and HS2.
And similar to the boxes that you were looking to tick when you were running the government property unit, what are the boxes you're looking to tick to turn Euston into a destination? Is it a cluster?
I think a cluster is one of the things that we'll be looking at, but obviously it's quite early days to go into extreme amount of detail. But we want to very much bring in what is in the surrounding area of Euston. So we want to work really closely with all the stakeholders. Obviously, our clients are HS2 and Network Rail and the government, but also from Camden, the residents there, all the universities around there, to actually make this something different. It's not a repeat of somewhere that already exists.
Okay, and Taylor, in looking at that north, south, east and west, Dan mentioned Croydon, you know, rebranding itself as something of a tech home. Do the companies that you invest in and work with, are they as agnostic about where in London they go?
So the companies that I invest in are comparatively small. They're fairly agnostic, and I would say they're mostly driven by the reality that they don't pay themselves very high salaries, so they live pretty frugally, and they'll go where they can afford the rent and live in shared accommodation and so forth. And they spend the vast majority of their time 7 days a week working on their startups. And so they're a little bit more easygoing about office selection. They don't have large budgets to kind of do fit outs and so forth. So I guess the answer is agnostic. But it tends to be in East London. So probably the biggest driver for them is, where do I need to be so that location is not a hindrance for the people that I'm going to need to hire, right? And so, you know, the short answer to that is East London, and so that's where they mostly are sitting.
And that's even more important than cost, is it? Given that they're quite small businesses and property is a comparatively small cost compared to some others.
Hiring is hands down the most important thing for a startup for many, many years in its life. So we've got our Hubbles and Open Sensors out there, whereas on the other hand, we have a new investment called Homie.Rent, where primarily the high volume of their hiring is in their homies who are essentially, you know, real estate service agents. And for the demographic they're serving in their customer base tends to be in West London. And so they need to hire people that can travel around in West London. And so that's where they're located.
Okay, thank you. We've only got a few minutes left. And I'd just like in these last few minutes to get a sense of the threats and the opportunities for London. London's had a tremendous run, and it's, you know, despite some macroeconomic shocks, it's continued to surprise on the upside, really. So is the opportunity maintaining that position, and are the threats, you know, tumbling very significantly from that position, or is there a greater prize out there, Dan?
Well, threats, and I suppose I should be mindful of my employer here working for a part of a very large French institution, but actually people talk about Berlin as being the obvious threat, certainly in the world of tech, to London in Europe, but actually the size and scale of Berlin is dwarfed by Paris. Paris is the only office market in Europe that replicates London. They claim it's twice as big as our market. We sort of tend to view that that's a use of statistics, which is a bit warped. But I think the interesting thing, if Macron succeeds with some of the challenges that he's got, and clearly he's got a moment coming up, hasn't he, with the unions, Paris is a very compelling proposition in many ways. I don't think actually their office stock is nearly as exciting as the office stock that we have in London, but that can change with good economic measures and good drivers for employers. That will drive the developers and the owners to produce the right stock. So I think Paris is potentially a threat, but actually if you look at what's happened in London in terms of the raw dynamic of take-up since the Brexit vote, I don't think anyone would have expected, even the keenest Brexiteer would have probably thought, yes, we're probably going to have a bit of a downtime in terms of London office take-up. So if we can have, in the period of uncertainty that we've had over the last couple of years, the strength of the market that we continue to have, London is succeeding in spite of the sort of slings and arrows that are being thrown at it at the moment. So yes, if we get certainty of what our future is going to be, which clearly we are at some point within the next couple of years, I think we're pretty well placed. But yes, watch what sort of Paris and Macron do.
Okay, Taylor, threats and opportunities.
Well, I guess they're two sides of the same coin, and I'll point out three things. Regardless of how Brexit goes, we need a really strong, compelling tech visa program so we can bring the talent in, right? Berlin, one of the attractive things about Berlin is that it's not too far from Eastern Europe, where there's just an absolute wellspring of technical talent. I would say the second thing is the tax incentives from an investment standpoint. So there were some recent announcements about the change of the enterprise management incentive scheme, which is which could be just devastating for the startup world. No reason to do that. So I think being careful about those sorts of things, and then finally, making sure that there's significant investment capital available to allow London to continue its sort of dominance of the early stage startup sector, and even increasing that availability to the kind of mid-stage startup sector, I think would be really valuable. So all three opportunities, all three poorly executed, would be threats.
Okay. Are you optimistic that they will be turned into opportunities rather than threats?
I am optimistic, yes.
Okay, thank you. And Ben?
One of the privileges of my job is that I get to meet occupiers of all shapes and sizes from all types of different sectors. And I would say across the board at the moment, there's a great optimism that there's opportunities for investment and growth in this country and in London particularly. So for as long as that sentiment's there, I think there's loads of opportunity for the London market. The threat is, I think what we discussed earlier is, are spaces going to be available to house that ambition and house that optimism? And that's what I see as the big threat to the growing London market.
Okay, thank you. And Sharon, Lendlease is making some very big long-term bets on London, so that there must be optimism there. But I wonder, as I asked in my initial question, what the size of the prize is. Is the prize to maintain London's current position, or can it be very much stronger?
I think maintaining a position or making it stronger is dependent on so many factors. Decisions to move aren't made on the spur of the moment. They're sort of 3, sometimes 4 years in the making. So it's about being there at the beginning of that process and thinking what it is that influences that. So we talked about talent, but we talked about space. The space, though, isn't just office space. It's also space to live. So that talent needs somewhere to be. And what we haven't talked about is actually affordable housing. So that's going to be a factor. Now, that's something very much on the government agenda, and it's something within our development pipelines. We're very, very passionate about the right places to live at the right price. Then there is, I suppose, what we're seeing that London is very strong about, which is actually the university and education system. The UK universities consistently are in the global top 20, whereas there aren't actually that many wider continental European universities on that. So we're creating those people. But to retain them, they need a home. They need the right kind of taxation environment, which we have at the moment, but we'll have to see what the future brings. And then that taxation environment brings the investors, as do all the various things. So it's such an interconnected web. But as with all webs, if you tweak on one bit of it too much, it can unravel. But so far, I think it's holding together. And if we make the right decisions over the next 3 to 4 years, give the right incentives to the right businesses and corporates over the next 3 to 4 years, when they're making those decisions now, I think I'm quite hopeful for London.
Hopeful. Okay, we've run out of time. There will be further EG London podcasts, so do listen out for those. But for now, Sharon, Dan, Ben and Taylor, thank you very much.